This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 250 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. This is a special episode. First, because it's our 250th episode, which is kind of a milestone. And second, because it's what we call a bits and pieces episode. Now, for those of you who've been with us for a long time, you know what that means. But for you who are new to this podcast, let me explain. Rob Mark, David Vanderhoof, and I strive to bring you a new episode each week, typically with an interesting guest. We record the show Monday evenings, but sometimes that falls on a major holiday when we really should be spending time with our families. This week is one of those times, as we have the Memorial Day holiday here in the U.S. Just a note to our international audience, and you are a huge portion of our listeners, Memorial Day is a day of remembrance for the men and women who died while serving in the United States Armed Forces. It's held every year on the last Monday in May, and its origins actually trace back to the American Civil War. Well, because we're really committed to producing this program for you, we do something we call bits and pieces. Simply put, the three of us each come up with some kind of recorded segment, and we take those and put them together with our contributor segments, and the result is bits and pieces. So here's the lineup for this Bits and Pieces episode. First, David has an interview with David M. DeFelice, the Community Relations Team Lead at NASA Glenn. That was at Space Fest at the National Museum of the United States Air Force. Then I had a conversation with Ryan Ewing, who runs a site called Airline Geeks. Ryan is quite the enthusiast, and his aviation passion started out at a very young age. Next, Rob Mark seems to be having a little trouble with the president's choice of Anthony Fox to replace Ray LaHood as secretary for the Department of Transportation. Then Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast have their Australia desk report. They're going to talk about the ditching of a Pelair Westwind jet, Airbus sponsoring the 2013 Fly Your Ideas Global University Challenge, and some RAAF activity. Then we have Peter Johnson with his Across the Pond segment. Peter takes a break from having a guest this week. He responds to Rob on the Jetstream and mentions his son's trip to one of the most dangerous airports in the world. Peter leaves us with a question about aerospace domination in the next century. And then listener Micah sent us a recording of a recent flight that he took. He calls it Moving Map, so we'll play that. All right, let's get started. Here's David's interview.
Hello, folks. It's David again. We're at Space Fest here at one of the world's greatest aviation museums, the National Museum of the United States Air Force. And I'm with David DeFelipis, who is from NASA Glenn, the center. David, thank you for being on the Airplane Geeks.
Glad to be with you, David.
And tell me a little bit about NASA Glenn. And I'm assuming a little bit more in the A portion and not the S portion.
Well, certainly, yeah. A is the first day in NASA's aeronautics, but we're excited to be here for Space Fest as well. And so NASA Glenn is in Cleveland, Ohio. We're right adjacent to Hopkins Airport. Matter of fact, we have runway privileges there, so our flight research aircraft can go in and out and conduct our operations out of our hangar. But we're excited to be here for Space Fest. We were excited to hear that they got the crew compartment trainer, which is one of the key trainers all the astronauts trained in Houston before they did their shuttle missions, and so just arrived here last summer. On display now in kind of a partial state, letting folks today for the special event kind of walk up and take a look into it, and eventually they're going to build out a whole exhibit and let folks on a routine basis get up close and check it out.
And what actually are we looking at? How much of the space shuttle?
It's basically the front nose compartment, if you will. So it comprises the flight deck, where the pilot and commander and two or three mission specialists would sit during launch and landing. And then below that is the mid-deck level, where they had their lockers for storing things. And that's where if you had additional crew members would sit down there during a launch and re-entry. And so some of the hardware we brought with us today is an actual experiment that was conducted. Attached to the mid-deck locker area for actually 10 different shuttle missions, and it's called the Solid Surface Combustion Experiment, and it's a small combustion chamber, and we have on display outside of that the sample holder, so it really just a thin piece of paper that we would heat up electronically and intentionally start to fire, but safely inside a combustion chamber. And then next to the combustion chamber we have the science instrumentation rack with two high-speed cameras and the other instrumentation we would need. So basically at the designated time in the mission, when the astronauts have been trained, we go over, power it up, go through a start sequence, and then initiate the ignition, have the burn going on, and then we'd be able to bring that data back. But because it was a closed system, they could only do one burn per mission, so that's why we go 10 times. Behind that, we have an exhibit that shows a larger combustion chamber that flew a couple times on the space shuttle in the space lab area, with much bigger air to work, and we actually programmed into the astronauts' time, more time to do that, and they can actually swap samples in and out. So on the combustion module 2 version, we actually flew as many, I think, as the 7 different experiments in that one furnace for that. And then on the International Space Station, we built a refrigerator-size unit that's up there for astronauts to routinely conduct combustion experiments, and it has a companion for fluids experiments. So we don't actually work them together, so we don't put out the fires with the fluids, but we do have two different racks that way.
And what other things does the Glenn facility study?
Well, of course, we started as a part of NACA, National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, back in 1941. And so the genesis of the center itself was the fact that an entourage, including Charles Lindbergh, had gone over to Europe and time between the two world wars and said, what is it? Why, we invented flight, here in Dayton, and why is it that we're behind the Europeans? There's, all this stuff that they're doing. And the singular answer they came back with was engines. They're just gone ahead of us. You think you got, all these companies that were building, a little bit ahead of us, I think, in terms of the, car engine, those type of things. So they got a leg up on the aircraft engines. So they recommended that NACA develop an engine aircraft research laboratory. And after an extensive search, they selected the site in Cleveland to be the home of that. And that was our genesis. So to this very day, do a lot of work in aircraft engine work. By the time we're pretty much done building some of the major facilities, we're already starting in the jet engines. So, today we're focused on making aircraft, especially the engines, more fuel efficient, less environmental impact on them by reducing emissions, less noisy, all those types of things that you want to see happen in aircraft engines. We've been working through that over the years. And I can pretty much guarantee you just about every engine you see in these galleries, some way or another, we've had some impact on that over the years. That's the expertise at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as well, and in terms of their what they do. And so we've done a lot of joint programs with them over the years to improve aircraft engines, those types of things. So as you walk around here, engines are what make all these planes go, and that's our bread and butter, and that's what they do at Wright-Patt as well.
And you have three of my favorite aircraft. You have three S3 Vikings at the facility, which I was fortunate enough to see one of them last year at Oshkosh come in, which was really cool. It's nice to see somebody's keeping those flying.
Absolutely, and that's part of the job that I do, is I actually help make those arrangements to get the S3 up there last year, and so it's we try to get them out. It's kind of hard. They're research aircraft, so they're busy, and it takes money to get them up there. But we actually have an opportunity. coming up. We have monthly tours on one Saturday a month from April through October, and we can actually invite you to come out to the hangar and see the S3. As far as I know, I can't make promises. It might be off on a sortie somewhere doing some kind of flight station somewhere else, but typically it's there, and they'll try to have it there for that. So that's Saturday, August the 3rd. So you'll see the S3, which we're using as a research platform for a variety of things. We still have the Twin Otter, which was our bread and butter aircraft for doing icing research, and we're doing that, kind of platforms from other things. We still have a Learjet there, and we have two different T-34s that the pilots use. Actually, the reason why we have two is primarily for proficiency. Well, we started using one of them as a research platform so much that we got another one to start doing more proficiency things with. So the one S3 looks, as you saw, looks really cool. Full-blown NASA paint job on it and the logos and all that. The other two, still have their battleship gray and are primarily there for spare parts and things. Hope that if we use the one enough that we might get two flying, but right now that's the plan. And we actually have two retired Navy pilots that we kind of intentionally brought them in knowing we were getting the S3 because they had extensive experience on those. So.
Something you brought up that maybe we can talk to me a little bit, and it's not something we've talked about very much on the show, but we have a lot of airline pilots and a lot of talk about the experiments with icing.
Okay, icing, there's traditional icing, as you learn, and as you go through the World War II gallery, even some of the bookshop, there's a book about flying the hump and those types of things, the runs, the cargo runs over the Himalayas. And one of the issues they found early on is they were losing planes, not to enemy fires, but the icing conditions. They're getting up there and they're losing them. So we actually built in the 40s the world's largest icing research tunnel. And so we look at ice accretion on wings, on the, whether it's the props or the, nacelle for engines, and look at that. And we actually still do certification tests in partnership with the industry partners. This is one of the places they like to come. We've done that for rotorcraft and other vehicles, so that's a real key thing. But we've done with icing the whole gamut. So we've had the pilots flying the Twin Otters I mentioned, and pilots will appreciate it. Most pilots, you don't want to find the icing conditions, but these are the brave research pilots who say, look outside and see, icing conditions, and let's go from the we're actually we know it's a little bit more intense than that. They actually look at a weather map, where can we go to fly into icing conditions and not be in anyone's way. But that's the general idea there. But then we've also developed off of that computer models, because it's the key thing. It's very expensive to run wind tunnels and do tests, so the idea is to try to validate some computer models and see those, so as we're developing things we have the tools. But then the other aspect of it, we've done extensive work on pilot training videos. So your audience, maybe if they're not familiar with that, I encourage them to go to the Glenn website or just Google search for icing research training for pilots for icing conditions, and you'll see quite an extensive set of videos. There's DVDs, I believe, that are available, online training. So it's definitely a good thing for if you have to fly in and around this area in particular, to be aware of that.
And the website is?
You can go to www.nasa.gov is the main website, but you put a /Glenn, G-L-E-N-N, after that, that'll take you right to the Glenn Research Center's website. And we have a search box up there, and you can kind of surf around as well, but you'll find information there. On there, you also find information about our visitor center. So in addition to the tours are on our research facility on site. So you have to register for those in advance. I want to let you know you can't just show up on those, and you'll see that. You can get to that from the website as well. But we have now an off-site visitor center down at the Great Lakes Science Center in downtown Cleveland, where you can see a lot more extensive information about it. And the website for that is greatscience.com. We just opened up the first three of five new galleries. And this summer, at the end of June, early July, we'll be opening up the last two galleries. And in that last gallery, we're going to have an aeronautics lab, if you will, on it, talking about some of the icing research, some of the jet engine work, those types of things. So more to learn about that. So I want to make sure your listeners know to check that out as well.
And we definitely will put links in the show notes.
Excellent.
Again, David, thank you very much for being on Airplane Geeks.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you, David. Next up, my conversation with Ryan Ewing. Here it is. I'm speaking with Ryan Ewing, who runs a site called Airline Geeks, not to be confused with Airplane Geeks. Ryan, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you, Max.
Now, we're going to talk about Airline Geeks in just a minute. But first, I see that you have a few hours flying under your belt. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
I actually started to fly this year. This year, I flew in those Cessna 172s with an instructor.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it at first. The first time it was fun, but it just kind of got to me and I was kind of getting, you know, nervous to think about it once. I mean, you're looking at the controls, you're looking at your surroundings, and you're looking at the airport. There's a lot going around and, you know, plane's not the smoothest plane. So I decided, you know, for now I'm going to tone it down a little bit. Then Airline Geeks, it originally was Aviation Official, and that's when it started to build up. When I needed to get more, and I felt that urge to, you know, power down and
right.
learn more about my airline industry.
So your flight instruction is maybe on hold a little bit for the time being. But but when you do have more time and the ability to focus on that, are you pretty excited about? Had you been in a small plane before?
No. I mean, I've been on like little private jets on the ground before, you know, kind of touring them.
Yeah.
But I've never actually been in a small plane that small.
Wow. Well, good for you. I hope you continue with that. That's
thanks. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Pretty exciting. Now, how long has Airplane, see, I knew I was going to do this. How long has Airline Geeks been around? How long have you had the site?
Well, that's the story. Aviation Official started in about January, February. Actually, it started right near Valentine's Day. That's exactly what I remember. And Aviation Official had multiple goals. It was a mess at first. It was just a lot of things just around it. I've gotten advice from multiple people and it's sort of, you know, kind of grown. And then I decided, you know, Aviation Official, people can interpret that in many ways. So I wanted a very simple, down-to-earth name,
mm-hmm.
and that really reflects my site. And Airline Geeks was the best one I could think of because it was available on Twitter, available on Instagram. It was available as a domain name.
Right.
And there wasn't, you know, an Airline Geeks out there. So I thought, you know, this would be a great connection to connect, you know, hashtag AV Geeks together and into like a social network forum similar to Facebook. And then also to make a great aviation blog. And really, the aviation blog is my utmost goal at this point.
Yeah, I see on your site that, yeah, you have a couple of different, I guess I call them sections, different areas. And and the blog is one, but you also have some other sections as well, some photos and things like that. You do seem to have a lot of photos on the site here and there. Now, did you take all those pictures yourself?
Yeah, I've taken all of them myself. I encourage people to post on the site.
Uh-huh.
If they're a member, they can post on it. That's one thing I do encourage. But all of them are mine for now.
Very good. Yeah, that's great. So do you consider yourself an airplane spotter?
I do. I try to go airplane spotting, you know, once a month. I live here in the D.C. region, so I can go, you know, to Washington Reagan is a big one. It's,
right.
There's Gravelly Point Park. It's right at the end of Runway 19. The planes will come in about 200 feet above you, and it's pretty amazing. I mean, even if the planes are taken off. And then another place I just recently discovered is at Dulles. There's the parking garage 2, level 5. You can look over at runway 1C, and I got some pretty good pictures from there. Hoping maybe to go there this weekend, actually maybe to see the Ethiopian 787.
Yes, right.
Yes.
Well, it's pretty exciting that the 787s are getting back up in the air. I think you're probably as happy as almost everybody else to see that.
I am. I'm pretty happy that the American carrier is putting them back in the air, United. But as soon as I heard, you know, Ethiopian, as soon as the FAA said, okay, Ethiopian was the first airline just to jump on it and say, you know, we're putting this plane in the air.
Mm-hmm.
When I heard that, I was so happy because I really missed it because, you know, it was an amazing, graceful plane. I think the problems were avoidable. Honestly, I do.
The problems with the batteries?
Yes, I think it was proper prevention prevents poor performance. You know, they would have prevented that, you know, from happening, and they would have thought, you know, put the exhaust button in there, this wouldn't have happened. Or if they would have taken a little more test flights before just throwing it into service, I think that would have been the safer way to go.
Yeah, no doubt Boeing has had a lot of conversations about how they could have avoided this and, yes. and maybe more importantly, how they could avoid or would avoid something similar to this happening in the future because
yes.
The cost is just so high.
The cost for Boeing and it's the cost for the passengers. You know, the passengers, it's been about 5 or 6 years since there's been a good plane out there.
Right.
Effective, attractive, you know, looks right. good.
Yes, it does, doesn't
it? It's a track, you know, when you get in the cabin, you actually feel like, oh, I want to fly in this thing compared to another day, another dollar. You know, it's just, I think the 787 student, I vaguely remember it being just a concept and now I can see it in person. Same with the A350.
Yeah, you know, Ryan, that's an interesting point because we don't often have the pleasure of yeah. watching something new, you know, a new airplane like this, you know, come about and to sort of, you know, be around from the beginning is kind of exciting.
Yep.
And I really like how Boeing engaged the public in the design. I mean, not directly, but they, you know, online they had lots of activities to
that's what I was just gonna
feedback.
Say.
Yeah.
They really wanted the passengers to feel it. They really wanted the passengers to go online to Boeing.com and, you know, they made it really interactive. Like, I think it's still on there. You can actually go through the whole plane. You can circle it and you can go inside and you can, you know, click yeah. on the little, information buttons. It tells you about it. And that's a great way to engage the passengers. And that also influences the airline's profits.
Right, for sure. So when did you become interested in airlines or how did you become interested in airlines? Where did this all start for you?
Well, that's an interesting question, Max. Actually, when I was ever since I was little, first time I flew, I was probably less than a year old, but probably a little more. And I loved the planes. You know, I'd sit there and just look out the window. And ever since, you know, I was little, but I never really grasped, you know, the fact that I never really actually liked them. I just like, you know, I'm like airplane, you know, when I saw it.
Yes.
But then as I got to about 10, I got a flight simulator. And I love that. I have like 500 hours on it.
Wow.
Yeah. And I enjoyed that, but now it's not really working. And then it gradually kind of grew up. And finally, I'm at this point where I cannot get enough of it. You know, I just love it so much that it's like a passion for me. Like every topic that comes into my mind, I have to try to connect it to aviation.
That's great.
It's always been a passion of mine, but especially in these, you know, last 3 or 4 years, it's really hit me. You know what I mean?
Yes, for sure.
Yes.
That's great. And you're not exactly an old man like Rob, are you?
No.
How old are you, Ryan?
I'm actually, I'm a teenager. Yep. I'm a 13.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah. So that's, I really love that, Ryan, because, you know, a lot of 13-year-olds don't have as much sort of focus or, you know, as much passion for a specific topic.
Oh, yes.
You know,
yes.
as you. And so you're kind of living that and, you know, it's yeah. great that you put together the Airline Geek site and the,
yeah.
and the blog and all. How often do you put posts up on the blog or what's your goal for the blog?
Well, I have two goals for my blogging and I guess you could say airline journalist skills is one, I want to, really have good pictures, you know. I want to, you know, have a very factual post when I post, you know, very well detailed. But I don't want my post to be too long. Like uh-huh. as you can spread my Southwest Airlines revolutionizing air travel one, you know, that's pretty long. But every 3 or 4 articles, maybe I'll write one like that. But I want, you know, if my MD-80 one on there, it's gotten, you know, a lot of feedback, and it's only 7 sentences or something like that long. And that my goal is to have a short and sweet articles, well detailed. And my second goal would be to have good journalist skills, you know, how to find the details and how to, you know, get good pictures mm-hmm. and how to add very good facts to my articles.
The American Airlines article, the MD-80 article you mentioned, that's the one's title. Yeah. What will American Airlines do with its MD-80s?
Yeah.
And as we're recording this right now, I see that you've got 10 comments for that yeah. one post, which is, yeah. that's fantastic.
I was actually on a vacation and I was looking at my iPhone. I was looking at my site statistics, and I go on it, you know, expecting maybe 25, 30 views, and it was 1,000 something views.
Wow.
I was petrified. I couldn't think straight for the last rest of my trip. I was so petrified, you know, whoa, you know, 1,000 views.
That's fantastic. That's amazing. You should be very proud of that, Ryan.
Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. What do you think? Let me ask you sort of a general question about the airlines. What do you think are the kind of the big issues or some of the important issues that we might see in the coming months with regard to the airlines? Any thoughts on that?
That's a very interesting question. If you think about it, no one except me, you, and the rest of the AV geeks out there like flying. I mean, I'm going to be honest. It's one of those things people in this world and country just, they kind of, you know, they take advantage of it. You know, people back in the days, you know, they thought, oh, this is great. You know, they dress up in suit and ties. But if airlines don't step it up, you know, they don't modernize with the, you know, 21st century, they're going to have problems. Like Delta, they opened up Terminal 4. They call it T4. It's up on the, they have a balcony on the top of the airport that actually you can overlook. And it's more of a terrace, I guess you could say. It's more of a sky club. And they also have sky priority check-in, and it's really modern. And I think Delta's, they're really, you know, running past, they're really getting there, but they've been very modern. They've had their own like touch on the modernizing of air travel. You know, they have planes, aircraft that, you know, all other airlines have, well, not all, I mean, some airlines have, but for some reason they're very modern about it. Their website, if you go to delta.com, it's very clean, modern. Their advertisements are very modern and clean as well. But I think the problems, if I had to pick three problems, I think one is people, as you know, especially tall people, the seats. I can barely fit in these seats. I mean, anymore. I mean, the economy seats. They're so small that it's going to become a problem to the point where either people are going to start booking first class and they're going to have a lot of overbooked first class seats, or two, people are just not going to fly in economy and just they're going to book on another airline with premium economy, for example, which is the premium economy is a great tactic for airlines to grasp, in my opinion. The second issue I think they're going to face is the drinks. Free drinks is something, but some airlines offer this. I'm not going to name specific airlines because it'd take me a little bit, but I could name maybe one or two. JetBlue, and I'm not sure, but I think Virgin America offer free snacks, and that's another great tactic because when you're hungry, you want to eat.
Sure.
And when you're in the midair, you know, you want a snack and you want to, you know, a drink. And if other airlines, like especially regionals, are they going to charge you $3 for a thing of peanuts when you can fly on JetBlue and get them for free? I think these other carriers, like I'm not going to name the name, but they're going to have a, you know, they're going to have issues in the future with that. Then the final third issue I think they're going to have is that the aircraft are just slowly getting old. Like, American Airlines, I'm not sure as of now, but I think in the past they're the airline with the oldest fleet. But their planes are very long lasting for some reason because they're very well maintained aircraft. But the problem is that these planes are loud. Like the MD-80 is a loud plane.
Sure.
And passengers don't want a loud plane where they're listening, you know, their music and stuff, or they're watching their movies. You know, they want a, you know, a quiet plane. And I think that's one thing. Like as I mentioned, the 787. And these newer aircraft like the A350, A380, A320, Neo are going to grasp.
Yeah, there is a big difference.
There is
with the new aircraft, and yeah, passenger comfort is really big and important. And the noise, boy, you know, not only just from an environmental standpoint and having a smaller noise footprint that you know lets them sort of increase their operations at
there's some
at airports.
There's one airport in Orange County. If I remember correctly, Orange County Airport is, I don't think that's the name, specific name, but it's Orange County, and I think it's the main airport there. When they take off, they have to, because some people get so annoyed below them that the planes are so loud. Personally, it wouldn't bother me. But when they're taking off, they have to, about, I guess, right when they hit the highway, they have to go back to idle and then continue to climb, which is, you can see videos of that on YouTube. It's pretty commercial airliners.
Hmm.
I don't think it's that. That's why they need to make these quieter planes on the outside and inside for that reason, so they don't have the noise restrictions around airports too that can affect the safety of the aircraft.
Shifting gears a little bit, Ryan, I noticed on your blog some photographs of the models that you've built.
Well, I haven't built them. I've ordered them and then snapped them together. I mean, technically, you could say that's building.
I would tell my friends I built them, but yeah. I love the way you have them displayed, though. You have them in nice shelves. Some of them have glass doors over them. Really, really nice. Do you consider yourself a modeler?
I have 20 models here. I love each one of them. You know, they really are detailed. I mean, I'm going to be honest. I'm not going to name the brand name, but some of them are. I mean, I have multiple brands. Some of them are very well detailed. And I have a 787 model. The engines will even turn if you blow into them. The wings curve and stuff like that.
That's some great detail. Yeah,
they are. They're pretty amazing how they build those too.
All right, maybe one final question, Ryan, that I'm kind of interested in knowing, and you can tell me as much or as little about this as you want. Are your parents supportive of your interest in aviation? Yeah.
They're pretty supportive. Well, they're actually very supportive. They'll take me plane spotting. They're fairly impressed with me, you know, as I build my site. They, you know, let me, you know, sometimes they'll help me buy one of my, you know, models or, you know, my airline memorabilia and stuff like that. So I do appreciate, you know, that's one thing that they do help me with a lot.
Well, that's good. Good for them. Are they involved in aviation at all themselves, or that's kind of your interest?
I'd like to say my father, he enjoys aviation. He enjoys it. He doesn't know as much, obviously, as I do, but he enjoys it. You know, we'll stand out there, you know, parking garage 2, a level 5 at Dulles, and we'll look over, and, you know, he enjoys it. You know, he likes to be up there.
Well, that's great. It's good to hear. I think
it is.
It's important, I mean, in general, for parents to be supportive of,
it is,
you know, the activities and the interests of their kids, but especially with something as, you know, it's sort of as special as you have going on. This is, their support is really fantastic.
Yep. Uh-huh.
So, Ryan, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find your site and where they can find you on Twitter and all that kind of contact information.
So basically, if you go to airlinegeeks.com, that's my home site, as Max has mentioned. My Twitter handle is airlinegeeks, and my Instagram handle is airlinegeeks as well. So, you know, follow me on Twitter. You know, I appreciate your follow, and you can ask me your aviation questions. I'll be happy to answer.
All right. Fantastic. So, Ryan, again, we really love your passion and enthusiasm, and look forward to talking with you some more in the future.
That sounds great.
All right. Well, Ryan's quite an interesting young man. I think it's always just so nice when you run across someone that has such a passion for aviation or anything else, for that matter, at such a young age. And I think there's great things ahead for Ryan, and it'll be great to watch him progress. All right. Next up, we have Rob Mark. Rob wrote a little piece about President Obama's selection for a replacement for Ray LaHood at the Department of Transportation. Here's Rob.
After we recorded this week's episode of the Airplane Geek Show, I decided to turn over a new leaf and stop whining about people like the new DOT secretary. Well, to be honest, of course, I had a little motivational help from our guest last week, Jason Parr. Jason's a Wired magazine writer and an admitted airplane geek. Prior to the show, I'd read his really excellent story at Medium.com. It was called Lift and Drag, and it wonders what happened to our love of flight. I highly recommend it. Jason explained the upshot of his exploits at Medium.com and mentioned as an industry, it might be time for a little less, well, editorial whining and a little more aviation love. And Jason, I must confess that as a confirmed complainer, I heard you. And God knows, I really do want to curb my appetite for calling people out. That said, however, I don't think I can pull the reins in this week after reading clips from the Hill's transportation blog. They spoke about the president's selection of Anthony Fox, the former mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina, as the replacement for Ray LaHood as Department of Transportation Secretary. As a guy from one of Mr. Obama's home states, in addition to Ray LaHood's, of course, I promised myself I was going to try and keep my mouth shut when Anthony Fox was first named to fill the slot. Jason, I really did try. Honest, I really did. But then the Hill's reporter Keith Lang reminded me that some critics are upset. And they're upset because, well, Mr. Fox has no real transportation experience. I wondered whether it was even going to become a topic at last week's Senate hearing on Mr. Fox's confirmation. Of course, it really wasn't. And of course, it was about then that I remembered the transportation slot is one of those department head positions the White House hands out to friends for good PR. Because really, how much trouble can a transportation secretary really get themselves into? Airport or ATC service funding falling apart on your watch? No big deal. The Fox will fix it. As Ronald Reagan once said when an opponent tried that same old political rhetoric on him during a debate, there you go again. And so Mr. Obama, after 4 years of Ray LaHood, a man who has proven over and over again how little he understands about the aviation industry at all, you've decided his replacement is going to climb no higher in their transportation knowledge than that shin-nibbling level you set for Mr. LaHood. Sorry, but to hand over the policy-making reins of a multi-billion dollar network of aviation, automobile, rail, and maritime products and services to a man with no experience reminds me again that, well, you need to have your head examined. Maybe as closely as I called for when people thought it was George Bush that was the only problem with aviation. For aviation, Mr. Obama, you and your White House sarcasm about fat cats and their private jets are really no better than Mr. Bush. And lately, I've come to realize that what a Hill insider told me a month or so ago is really true. The White House views aviation as an acceptable loss of constituents. So is there any hope? Well, that light at the end of the tunnel emerged right in the middle of the economic calamity the Democrats created. They called it sequestration. Did you notice how quickly air traffic controllers returned to their jobs when Congress had to wait in line at the airport like the rest of us? And did you notice how the contract tower issue started evaporating once thousands of people began complaining? That proves to me that Congress will listen if we speak with a common voice and in great numbers. During a low point in another recent conversation with a congressional staffer, I bemoaned the White House's lack of attention to the aviation industry. I asked this man what we as industry stakeholders could do to get the president's attention. Write your congressman, he told me. It works. It really does, he added. We listen to people who call, and we read their emails and letters, especially when we receive lots of them. In fact, he told me, it's still the only way to push any agenda forward. From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 27th of May, 2013, folks.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 250. Good Lord, Grant, that's a lot of episodes.
I think so, man. That's a pretty special deal, guys. Congratulations. 250 episodes and still going strong. Well done to the geeks.
Absolutely. And, you know, Grant, episode 250, that's about 200 episodes since you and I started recording together,
it's
as it turns out.
Getting pretty close. Yeah. It's getting pretty close.
Yeah, now, it's not Australia Desk number 200 because we've missed a few along the way. I reckon we're at about episode, for us, we're at about Ausdesk number probably about 192 or so, maybe 194. I'll have to check.
You know, if we'd played our cards right, we could have really done well here because we could have had the Ausdesk number 200 with Airplane Geeks 200. We could have had the Ausdesk number 200 at Airplane Geeks episode 250 because we started around number 50. And then we could have the real 200th Ausdesk produced. Well, we could have had three 200s, man.
We could have, mate, but that would have required us to have been completely organized over the last 4 years, and that's just no way that's going to happen.
Yes, okay, moving right along.
It'd require a work ethic, which neither of us really have, so there we are.
Ah, mate, I need another beer. Let's talk about the news.
Okay, going back to the news, and I guess when we started recording was way back in mid-2009, and not long after that, there was an interesting plane crash that happened in Norfolk Island, which is a protectorate of Australia. It's out in the Pacific Ocean, and a few hours flight time from the mainland here in Australia, and there was a crash out there of a Westwind aircraft operated by a company called Pelair at the time, and who knew, Grant, that that would have turned out to become one of the more controversial ATSB investigations in recent history.
Basically, the reports handed down by the ATSB with CASA's assistance all pointed the finger of doom to the pilot. Unfortunately, they were saying that it was his fault they ran out of fuel, the way he handled the flight. But when this came out, a lot of people were up in arms because they were pointing out that CASA had been examining the Pelair and weren't happy with some of the things they'd found, but hadn't acted on them. They also pointed out that the chief pilot at the time of the accident at Pelair was now working as a CASA investigator, and a number of other items that were all said to be indicative of CASA's procedural failures and so on, and the ATSB covering it over, which really raised a few eyebrows and not a few heckles on the part of the ATSB and CASA, who were getting a little bit upset about all this. And the whole thing wound up spurning a Senate inquiry called by Senator Nick Xenophon, whom we've had on the show a couple of times, and he organized a Senate inquiry, and they've been delving into the issue, and the results have come out, and it's not painting a very nice picture of the Australian Transport Safety Bureau, which is our equivalent of the NTSB, and CASA, the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, our equivalent of the FAA. And of course, ATSB and CASA are denying and saying they've done nothing wrong, but the Senate committee has actually referred the federal police to go and investigate CASA for withholding information.
The interesting thing about this, and we should point out, Grant, that what happened with this aircraft was that it actually ditched into the sea just off Norfolk Island because it ran out of fuel, and it was a medical evacuation flight. Now, fortunately, everybody survived, which was great, but the captain of that flight, Dominic James, basically his career has been left in tatters as a result of this, and you know, there's been some media coverage of that over the years. In fact, Grant, I think we might have talked about this a year or so back. Although he's not been out there saying too much publicly, I'd say he's been pretty desperate to clear his name. I think it's always been his contention that there were bigger things going on than just him making some sort of basic error.
Well, for instance, the Pelair operations manual did not have information about how to plan the fuel, apparently, which sounds very odd. Basically, it was up to the pilot's discretion. And a number of other areas that Pelair was found deficient, not least of which was that their aircraft weren't certified to operate at the high altitudes required for the most efficient fuel burn, which led to the aircraft being forced into the lower levels on this flight, which chewed up more fuel. And a few other procedural issues in terms of oceanic control, not passing on some weather information, and a number of other items that have all come through, indicating that, yes, the blame does stop with the pilot in most issues, but it's not all his fault is what's coming out. And one of the other things that's come out through the Senate inquiry is that the Senate have stated that they do not wish CASA to enact retribution on those that have come out and said things against it. That's just mind-boggling for them to even consider that they had to say that.
Interestingly, the report here says a number of very stern things here, but just one line here I read in the article in australianaviation.com.au. It says here that, quote, "The committee was understandably troubled by allegations that agencies whose role it is to protect and enhance aviation safety were acting in ways which could compromise that safety." Now, they're pretty strong words, and there was plenty of others too. We'll put a link in the show notes to that, but yeah, there's going to have to be some big, big changes. These things have been going on, and they certainly transcend different flavours of government.
That much is certain, mate. And we've already seen CASA putting out a number of newsletters and distributions, all pointing out where they believe they did the right thing and that this is not correct and that they do have a safety-centred approach and so on. So we're basically going to be watching this over the next month or so as it unfolds and see what the federal police turn up and other items that have been raised from the Senate inquiry.
Yes, and I tell you what, the spotlight is going to fall squarely on the head of John McCormick, the head of CASA. And actually, Grant, just tonight as we record this, I noticed that Mr. McCormick has released a video talking about some of their actions and what they're doing to make aviation safer, amongst other things. So I guess a bit of a public relations exercise there by Mr. McCormick. Grant, who you've also interviewed recently.
That's correct, mate. I had a quick chat with him about his flying career and the fact that he has a Yak 50 single seat aerobatic aircraft.
That's probably the easiest interview he's had in a while, I can tell you that.
He did seem pretty happy about it.
Okay, now moving along to some interesting news here, and we might just mention here a student team from the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, better known here as RMIT, and that's a big university here in Melbourne. Grant, they've done very well in a recent competition that Airbus has been running to basically come up with some interesting concepts and some design ideas and some engineering ideas, and looks like they're doing really well. The cryogenic liquid methane aircraft is what they've come up with, and Airbus is seemingly quite impressed with that.
That's right, mate. This is the third of the Airbus Fly Your Ideas challenges. They happen every 2 years. The first time it was run in 2009, it was won by a Queensland team. I'm not sure who won it in 2011, and now it's 2013, and our team from RMIT is on the short list along with teams from Brazil, India, Italy, and Malaysia. So, yeah, the idea is to come up with proposals to make aircraft more economical, better for the environment, all those kind of aspects. They put the ideas through, they go through a few stages, and then the finalists are all flown to France, and there's a big awards ceremony in Paris, and that's coming up in June.
And I'll tell you what, Grant, if they win that, they'll win the cool sum of 30,000 euros, which is 39,000 Australian dollars, and boy, that'd be good. You know, we should enter that ourselves. I wonder if they could use a podcasting studio on an airline. Do you think that would help efficiency at all?
I don't know, but I think it's right up there with your, you know, used chip oil system that you were discussing some Ausdesks ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, we can always run things on a budget, Grant, which gives me another great segue. Let's talk about budgets. The Australian federal budget was released in the last couple of weeks, and some interesting things there. From a defence standpoint, it looks like they're going to, amongst many other things, retire at least one of the Royal Australian Air Force's AP-3C Orions, and fantastic aircraft, but quite old aircraft, one must say.
That's right. I'm pretty sure this is the oldest one in the fleet in terms of having re-lifing and so on. They went through a big re-winging project not too long ago and extended the life of the Orions. They have actually retired one whole airframe, and that may not sound like a lot, especially to those of you who are used to having hundreds in your fleet. But for us, that's probably a big enough saving that it is actually having an impact on the funds available for other projects, such as purchasing the Triton drone.
Yes, the MQ-4C Triton. And it says here, Grant, in an article here in australianaviation.com.au, that Australia has in fact issued a letter of request to the US government inquiring about perhaps what would be involved for Australia to get involved with that program.
Yeah, so it works very well with the Poseidon that we're getting, the Broad Area Maritime Surveillance, aka BAMS. The Triton would probably be able to stage out of the Edinburgh military base near Adelaide. So having a few of these on the force would certainly do wonders for our maritime surveillance and coastal patrol. We've got a lot of coastline up the north end of Australia and not a lot of people. Very easy to slip through. A lot of smugglers, both people and drugs and so on, fly or boat their way through at the top end. And these aircraft would help keep an eye on that and route other manned missions and so on to intercept.
Yes, so as I've said before, Grant, and I guess a lot of people are saying, drones are inevitable. There's going to be more of them in the skies, and that's just a reality, I think, of aviation life as technology moves forward. Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. After 200 episodes with Grant and Steve in the mix here at Airplane Geeks, it's a wonder the show survived it all, but I congratulate all the crew there at the Airplane Geeks for putting up with us for all of these episodes and all these years.
Oh, mate, they've done an excellent job, and thanks to them, we're here. We wouldn't have started without them. So as we've said a number of times.
So we'll catch you all again next week, folks. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm the phased out Grant McCarron.
Phased out? Well, let's phase in our own podcast, Grant. You know, with this segment goes so long, we should just make our own.
Oh, I think that's a pretty good idea, mate. You might be onto something.
Sounds like deja vu. I think someone's had that idea before.
Ah, I'm sure we've met before.
This is not the podcast you're looking for.
And now it's time for Peter Johnson, Across the Pond.
So it's time for another voice recording segment from over here across the pond, and I wanted to start with an apology. Over the past month, there's been several stories about Air India, and also Rob mentioned Luckla Airport. That's the one wedged on the side of the Himalayas in Nepal, which is regularly quoted as the most dangerous airport in the world. Well, I'd lined up Rohit Rao from Aeroblogger to come onto the show and talk to us about these, but due to my schedule and domestic issues, I've had to postpone the interview several times. Now, I know that Rohit was keen to join us, so my apologies to Rohit, but please do look him up on the aeroblogger.com and on Twitter at the Aeroblogger. So, Rohit, sorry about that. We will catch up very soon. I thought I'd say a few words quickly, though, about Luckler Airport. As some of you may be aware, my son trekked up to the base camp of Everest earlier this year and used Luckler to fly in and out of. Now, not being an aviation fan, but obviously a bit of a challenge junkie, Alex loved the flight in and out, which really is like a sort of aircraft carrier launch where the aircraft picks up speed and seems to just shoot off the edge of the mountain. I think he flew in a Twin Otter or something like that. He loved it and he wasn't bothered about the record at the airport at all. So I'll put a picture or two in the show notes for everyone to have a look at that. Now, my next item involves some comments from Rob. Now, listen to this. Well, Rob, how can you dare say that any aircraft is too loud? You'll be saying next that those darn jets are too noisy at those darn air shows. What sort of an airplane geek complains about the noise? Now, I get it, if you're a little too close to any aircraft without ear defenders, it can be a little uncomfortable. But for me, and from someone who saw The Who a few decades ago when they were recorded as the loudest band ever, I say bring it on. To me, those Garrett engines sound great. In fact, I really enjoyed flying the Jetstream and even recording Across the Pond segment. I think it was episode 145. I never found it any less spacious than what we have nowadays on modern jet aircraft. And I really enjoyed the ambience that that the aircraft and the air crew created. Maybe it was the carrier or the layouts. But for me, the Eastern Airways Jetstreams were really an enjoyable AvGeek experience.
You're listening to Across the Pond, coming to you from the front seat of an Airbus.
Terrain, terrain, pull up!
Okay, so finally, to last week's show, David made me think a little bit about a comment that he made, and I want to place a question to ourselves and to our listeners. Just a little bit of background, though. My grandmother was born just before the start of the 20th century and saw lots of innovations in aerospace during her lifetime. The first heavier-than-air flight, the use of aircraft for war and transport, the jet engine, supersonic travel, and, of course, men on the moon and missions to Mars. Now, when my nan was born, Britain and many other nations had significant interests and power around the world. The British Navy was, of course, very strong. But there was a new power evolving that would come to dominate the 20th century, and that, of course, was the USA. It flew the first aircraft and eventually launched a man to the moon. Now, in aviation terms, there really was no other air power that could challenge it, and that probably still exists today. And that's where David's comments came from. But is this turning? You know, US airlines and manufacturers dominated air transport, building enormous numbers of aircraft for massive air growth across the US. Boeing still today builds some of my favourite airliners and fighters. But is it changing? 30-odd years ago, European nations collaborated and through private investment then went on to evolve to be Airbus, who I would say smashed all records in the past few years with the A320neo, pushing Boeing to respond with the 737 MAX. You know, American and United, when I grew up, were the biggest airlines in the world, dominating demand for airliners, almost prescribing the aircraft requirements to the manufacturers and placing gigantic orders. Now, this definitely has changed with the new worldwide hubs evolving in the Middle East and Emirates et al. Now telling manufacturers what it wants from new designs. And we've seen this in the Boeing 777X and the Airbus A350-1000 models. So from placing a man on the moon, I still think the US dominates space travel through NASA and exploration in space. But with the loss of the shuttle, human spaceflight launches now are in the hands of Soyuz. In fact, even now, ESA has three rockets launching from its base in French Guiana. Okay, so here's my question. What will evolve in the next 100 years in aviation and aerospace? Will the USA stronghold diminish, as did Britain's navy through the last century? Will manufacturing migrate to Europe or to China? I know some are mock Chinese aerospace manufacturing recently, but they certainly may start dictating as they buy up more manufacturing specialisms from the US and other parts of the world. Will India and Asia dominate? I genuinely don't know myself, but I'd love to see what our listeners think. Will history repeat itself? So on that note, this is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Now we have a short recording, a trip report, really, from listener Micah. Here he is.
JetBlue Flight 607 was over an hour late departing Portland, Maine, but I wasn't worried. I had cranky concierge on my side and had already changed my connecting flight in JFK. All was well, and I would end up in Fort Lauderdale instead of West Palm. The Embraer E190 was far from full, with over 30 empty seats. In fact, I changed my place from 16A, an even more legroom seat positioned between windows, to 25A, the last row of the aircraft, that was completely empty. We took off to the west on runway 29 and started a bank south at about 1,000 feet. I could see the horseshoe curves of the Scarborough Marsh as we climbed out. There was my friend Steve's house as we headed toward New York. It was a beautiful clear day, and I was looking east out my window with the entertainment system set to the moving map so I could track our speed and altitude. We were headed right down Interstate Route 95, only at 18,000 feet. I could see Portsmouth, New Hampshire clearly. There was a Piscataqua River, the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, the Submarine Albacore Memorial Park, and off in the distance, the Isle of Shoals. It was wonderful. I glanced up to the seatback screen. We were booking it, making up for lost time, traveling the JFK at 512 miles per hour at 21,000 feet. By now we were over Boston. I could clearly see the Zakim Bridge over the Charles River and even make out the cable stays. There was the Charlestown Naval Shipyard, the USS Constitution, and further east, Logan Airport was clear as a bell. A moment later, we were over Providence, Rhode Island, and Greene Airport. Actually, that made me think of Dan, as it was his home field. Off in the distance, I could see Newport. We cruised past Newport, and I was looking back at it when I realized I could see the tail of the E-190 from my seat. That was a first for me from a commercial aircraft. I looked up inside the plane and down the aisle to the flight deck. I saw that Mary Kirby was right. Everyone in the plane was looking at one or two screens at a time. Most had the window shades down. I wanted to shout out loud, "Hey, you guys, we're flying! Don't you know you're on a moving map?" I couldn't believe the complacency and lack of interest. If this flight were advertised as a narrated guided tour, people would pay thousands of dollars for it. Yet for an $80 flight, it was simply an inconvenience. We crossed Long Island Sound and the North and South Forks of Long Island. I was able to see Block Island, the Hamptons, and Montauk. We were slowing down and descending. Then came the announcement from the flight deck. JFK had ATC delays and was putting us in a holding pattern. There was a collective moan from the cabin, but I was delighted. We made our turn to the east and headed back north. I was now looking across Long Island Sound toward Connecticut. I could make out New Haven, Bridgeport, and Stamford. This flight could not get any better. But then it did. We were at 12,000 feet, 300 miles per hour, and made another turn when I saw it. An American 777 in the new livery. Airplane spotting from 12,000 feet. Wow! I watched it until it was out of sight. Another turn, and it got better again. A big, beautiful green bird against a clear blue sky, an Aer Lingus A330, but closer. An announcement from the flight deck told passengers not to panic and explained ATC separation standards to keep passengers calm. No one had even noticed. One last turn, and we were cleared to land. What a shame. I was the last one off the plane and stopped in the flight deck to thank the captain and first officer for a wonderful ride. I'm not sure if they were happy or puzzled that a 50-something-year-old man had an ear-to-ear grin on his face like a little boy. I had one more surprise in store for me, another first. When I got into the terminal and looked out the window across from where we had parked the plane, I got to see my first Airbus A380. Thank you, Singapore Airlines. It was parked right next to a Virgin Atlantic A340, which gave me great perspective. Now you may ask, what was the best part about what turned out to be one of the best commercial flights of my life? Well, the best part is being able to share it with all of you. You people who know exactly what a thrill it was for me and would have had the same feelings, even if it meant missing a connection. Thank you all for that.
Thank you, Micah. We encourage you to send us short, recorded stories that say something about your passion for aviation. It could be about a recent experience or how a certain person or event sparked your interest in aviation or anything like that. Now, most mobile phones and tablets have a feature or app that lets you record voice and email it or post the file to a service. Also, laptops usually have a built-in mic that you can use, so probably you already have the technology. Think a 3 or 4 minute recording, and we'd love to get those from you. All right, thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We really do this for you and hope you've enjoyed this bits and pieces episode. We'd like to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. Also, Peter Johnson, who you can find at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. You can find David Vanderhoof at his blog, whatjustflewby.com. And on Twitter, he's DM Vanderhoof. Rob Mark hangs out at jetwine.com. And on Twitter, he is jetwine. And you can find me at Max Flight on Google and also on Twitter. Show notes for this episode, this is number 250, are at airplanegeeks.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast right to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And that's also where you can send your recorded story. We also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. As always, Aunt Benet has the number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet. You can find her at aviationqueen.com, among other places. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Finally, remember that David, Rob, and I will be at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, Udvar Hazy Center, near Washington Dulles International Airport. That's on June 15th, 2013, for their Become a Pilot Day. This is billed as a family day and aviation display, and that's exactly what it is. You can learn more about it at becomeapilot.si.edu, and also check out their Flickr stream photos. Even if you aren't planning to go, you'll see why we love to attend this event. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.